Hello, I am Grant Boer, and I'm giving my talk on detecting Bluetooth surveillance systems. So to first start off, a bit about myself. I do work in security, but I don't work in anything that has anything to do with Bluetooth surveillance systems, traffic control, or anything of the sort. So this is my own research and has nothing to do with my employer or their opinions. This is really a little project that came about from reading a news story. I saw something mentioning little white boxes by the sides of the highway and people wondering what they were. And someone pointed out, they're Bluetooth sensors. Well, that's kind of an interesting idea. Why would there be Bluetooth sensors on the highway? And I think why this is in DC 101 is this is really a story of how do you go from, I read something interesting in the news to, well, let's just build something and find out what it's doing. And put something together and see what happens. So what I did for first was just start by, look around, look at the literature and see what is out there about why would there be Bluetooth sensors on the highways. And well, here are a couple of slides from the Federal Highway Administration. This is from the Wisconsin DOT, showing a Department of Transportation Bluetooth sensor. And you've got a field device with a Bluetooth scanner. It's a standard commodity Bluetooth dongle. It's not anything special. That's hooked up to a database server, and then it detects the Bluetooth-enabled devices in your car, whether that's your cell phone, the hands-free function of your car, Bluetooth headset you're carrying with you, whatever else. And it relays that back to the database server. And as we see in that second slide over there, the purpose of this is you detect a Bluetooth Mac once at one known location, then you detect the same Mac again later at another location. And now you know the speed of traffic between those locations because you know how far apart they are and you know the time delay between the Mac addresses. And that's why the DOT started putting these out there. And they're everywhere. Here we have an example of a little white box being installed alongside an interstate. You'll see a lot of the white box with a solar panel on top is probably the most common one you'll see. But it's far from the only one you'll see. These are all commercially available highway Bluetooth scanners. And some of them are remarkably commercial. And if you go to TrafficCast's site, there are pamphlets, buy our Bluetooth scanners and put them on your highway. And they're advertising to government departments of transportation. And so I looked around for some of the, research on this. And there's a research note from the Washington State Department of Transportation. And a couple of choice clips from that is the key advantages are the cost of the Bluetooth reader and that the MAC address collection device spans multiple lanes, providing a significant advantage over license plate readers that require lane-based detection. And in addition, Bluetooth-based travel time data collection systems are easy to install. Goes on to also talk about users not wishing to disclose their location can simply turn off the broadcast function on their Mac devices. We also have the state installing down at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, which is an Army base or military base south of Seattle, installing these sensors in place. So why would they use Bluetooth of all things? And turns out there are a variety of reasons. There are a lot of things they can use to monitor traffic. And the most basic is the loop. You see them in front of every traffic light. There's a little circle on the ground. And it detects from impedance when your car goes over it. The engine block changes the magnetic field. We also saw in a presentation by Cesar Cerruto a couple days ago, they do magnetometers too. And it's the same idea. But they only tell you traffic volume. And in addition, they can use radar. Radar will tell you traffic volume and traffic speed. But Bluetooth is one better because it also provides route choice. I can, before an intersection, put a Bluetooth scanner, and when someone drives by it, I get their Mac, and then I know which way they went by having other sensors on the intersection. And that's why the DOT likes having the Bluetooth scanners. The only other thing that will give them that is automated license plate readers, which are comparatively very expensive, and honestly have even more privacy implications than the Bluetooth scanner does. The Bluetooth scanners are inexpensive. They're $2,000 to $5,000 per detector, and frankly, the makers of the detectors are making a fortune at those prices. It's commodity hardware. They've got a cellular modem, solar power with a battery backup, or some of them run on power over Ethernet. They only get a 3% to 6% sample rate, which on one hand, obviously not everyone has Bluetooth, but that honestly seems a little low. And we'll get into why they're not getting most of the samples that go by. another thing the vendors point out a lot is that trucks are going to be oversampled because trucks have a lot more, a much higher percentage of trucks have Bluetooth devices in them than percentage of cars does. And so you have to adjust for that if you're a DOT and you're tracking people. You need to know that if I see X number of cars and my road gets a lot of trucks, I don't really have as many cars as I do if I'm on a road that isn't a trucking route. And so they do that adjustment. Another advantage they point out a lot is fewer privacy concerns. So Bluetooth is a weird protocol. And it's a weird protocol because as a frequency hopping spread spectrum pattern based on the MAC address of the device is communicating. So it's actually pretty hard to sniff traditional Bluetooth 1 and 2. BTL-LE is very different and it's really easy to sniff it. But you need to know the addresses of the device is communicating. And a Bluetooth address is, it's 48 bits like a normal MAC address, but it's divided into parts. There's the non-significant address part, which is a manufacturer ID. There's the upper address part, which is 8 bits. And the lower address part, which is 24 bits. You get LAP in every single Bluetooth packet. So it's easy to get that. If you want UAP, you have to capture a lot of packets and calculate it. It's not hard, but it takes a lot of packets. And any device can also send an inquiry, which is a special packet that always comes from a MAC address called the generic inquiry access code. And that's 98B3316. No idea why they picked that number. But that is the MAC address that says, this isn't really my address. I'm beaconing and asking, is anyone willing to pair with me? Once you get a response to a beacon, you can make a connection attempt. And a connection attempt will give you the device name, the device class, the service list, the clock offset, the rest of the stuff you need to actually form a connection and negotiate encryption and pair with the device. Turns out the highway scanners don't really care about much of any of that stuff. All they really want is LAP. They want an address. They want a unique ID. They don't care what data is being sent. They completely ignore the data. So as a result, they can sniff data in a few different ways. One is inquiry-based tracking, which is they set up the scanner to just spam inquiries all the time. Tell every device that comes by, hey, I want to pair with you. And any device that is in discoverable mode will respond. And that will give them their LAP. Another method is called connection-based tracking, and this is the scanner keeps paging for asynchronous connectionist link and logical link and adaptation protocol connections. This is really good if you already know somebody's Mac. This is the scanner you would use if you were wanting to track company cars around or track individuals through your building that are your employees, but it's not very useful for general surveillance. And finally, there's passive sniffing, where you just sweep the Bluetooth frequency range, you suck up packets, and you don't ever try to respond to any of them. The problem with passive sniffing is it requires non-standard hardware. You can't do it with your commodity Bluetooth dongle or what's in your laptop. So that may be a disadvantage to the DOTs. So here we have a couple more slides. This is from University of Washington Star Lab, and they are a traffic research area. And they installed on Highway 520's bridge in Seattle a automated license plate reader as well as a couple of Bluetooth scanners to compare the efficacy of the systems. And we have over here a graph of, you know, they monitored the Bluetooth devices and they got a certain percentage of RIM, Nokia, Samsung, LG. But we also have TomTom and Parrot SA and things. These are not phones. These are equipment in people's cars. It's their hands-free headsets and that sort of thing. So what about those privacy concerns that came up a little earlier that they said are minimized? Here is an article from Traffic Technology International. Yes, that is actually a magazine. I imagine it's not very interesting to most of us, but somebody subscribes to Traffic Technology International, and they talk about they have seen gains in matches over 50% over other methods with their patent pending other processes with their patent pending methods, which allow for far more robust analysis capability, including potentially differentiating transit vehicles. They say, we have the capability to make the MAC address data collected anonymous before transmitting from the field, which we can do without any reduction in the fidelity of the data. But isn't an anonymity a major feature of Bluetooth? If MAC addresses are not linked to a user, why the extra process? Well, they sound really good here. If there's even a very small chance that a hacker could sniff the communications pathway from field to host, there should be procedures and protocols in place to minimize the threat. Okay, so they kind of care about privacy. Now, here we have from a Star Labs paper, and they have an illustration there, gathering a couple of MACs from sensors, calculating travel times, strip the MACs, filter the results. What they talk about up here is the Macs are kept for an unspecified period, typically 60 minutes. That's what they say in their document. Now, this was from the experiment on 520 with the portable license reader and that sort of thing. Most of the commercial sensors I've looked at actually say they only keep the data 20 minutes, although it is user serviceable. Because once again, they're going after route choice. If you really wanted to put the sensors, 50 miles apart, you could do that, and then you would need to keep your MAC addresses for a longer period of time to be able to get the route choice data. So it's configurable, but yeah, the MACs are anonymous, and they throw them away after a short time. So clearly, there are no privacy concerns. Or that's what they say. So for instance, we shouldn't care that they're putting these on the Canadian border at all of the border crossings to monitor things. I bet they have them on other borders too. Canada just happens to be a heck of a lot closer to where I live, and thus was able to find out. Once again, these are from UW StarLab. So there are their three privacy mitigations they have. One is they're capturing LAP only. They're not getting your entire Bluetooth address. They're not cracking your code. They're not pulling the data. They don't care about any of that. They don't even make any attempt since that. With Bluetooth being a frequency hopping spread spectrum, they're really, with passive sniffing, they're only getting one packet in 64 anyway. Without cracking your UAP, well, it's not really cracking, but without guessing your UAP and pairing with you, or at least making a connection attempt, they can't follow your communication. They can't get most of the packets without doing a lot of stuff that the DOT has no reason to do. LAP is 24 bits. It's not globally unique. There's many Bluetooth devices with the same LAP. There are only 16.7 million possible LAPs. Next thing they do is they anonymize it. But if you remember that little article in Traffic Technology International, they say that LAP, they anonymize it, but while preserving the fidelity of the data. So the anonymous LAP matches one-to-one with a non-anonymous LAP. Now they can hash before storing, and if they wanted to, they could do salted SHA-256. They can, use good hashing practices. Then finally, their last mitigation is limited retention. And StarLab said 60 minutes. Commercial readers usually say 20 minutes is the default time. That's usually plenty because they'll put it before an intersection, they'll put it after an intersection, and so be it. That's all they need. So let's take a look at each of those privacy mitigations. So remember this, that little illustration of the manufacturers. Well, the manufacturers comes from NAP and not from LAP. So LAP does not permit manufacturer identification. So clearly, at least in their experimental reader deployment, they might have a little more than LAP captured, and not globally unique. One in 16.7 million is pretty unique for me in Seattle. There's one of me, there's maybe probably 2.5 million in the Seattle metro area, so there's only a 1 in 8 chance I match anybody, and I have more than one Bluetooth device. At that point, you've got a pretty unique signature of yourself. Now, once again, they're right that there is no there is no central registry of Bluetooth MAC addresses, at least not that we know of. And you can't necessarily get at somebody's Bluetooth MAC and just look in the DMV database and see who they are. On the other hand, what it does mean is this data would be useful for targeted tracking of a person. If you know there's a person you want to track around town, you do some research in other ways, you get brought a shot of liquor. just a moment. Well, I don't think Bluetooth.
No, I know how to do that. You actually, you look on the schedule.
And you see if it's their first
talk. You find them, and then you walk over and you give them a shot.
All right.
Not a shot or a real shot.
Would you like more?
It can be a real shot.
No. You don't have to take this peer pressure shit.
It's getting on. That's all right.
All right. How about some love for the newspaper?
I'm fine.
Back to tracking people.
All right. Back to tracking people, or not tracking them. So, all right.
Yeah, they all think it's easy after they do it.
So yes, one in 16.7 million, pretty unique in most areas. There's no central registry. But if you're already suspecting someone, if you're, say, the FBI or something of that accord, you can probably subpoena their cell phone provider and get their IMEI. And the phone manufacturer knows the serial number that goes with that IMEI, and the phone manufacturer knows the Bluetooth MAC that was put in by default by that phone. So if you're really tracking one person as a targeted attack, LAP is good enough. If you're trying to do dragnet surveillance, LAP is kind of useless. So anybody remember this? This is an interesting story. It's kind of unrelated, but not really. They talk about anonymizing your LAP. Well, this is from 2004, and this is the source code for the deck shuffling algorithm on partypoker.com. And they put this out to show how secure their deck shuffling algorithm is. And it on the surface, it looks very fair. You're taking each card in the entire deck, you're randomly swapping it with another card, and you go through the entire deck this way, and that gives you 52 factorial possible combinations, a full deck shuffle, 225 bits of entropy. But wait, they're using the random function in Pascal, and random generates a 32-bit number. So there's only 32 bits of entropy going into their 225 bits of entropy. And they seeded it by calling randomize. Randomize is the number of milliseconds since midnight. That's only a 26-bit number. So there's really 26 bits of entropy. So even though they're shuffling the deck perfectly, there are only 68 million possible decks that this algorithm can output. So somebody made a card shuffling rainbow table where they generated all 68 million possible decks. And they get dealt their whole cards and say, oh, this was the first and second card out of the deck. How many of those 68 million start with these two cards? And then the flop comes out. Well, how many have those as cards 9, 10, and 11? And then they're down to one deck, and they can predict the entire rest of the deck. So the moral of the story is you cannot anonymize a 24-bit number. You can't take a 24-bit number and turn it into a 256-bit salted hash. Somebody could just try all 24-bit numbers, and they'll hit it. It's trivial to brute force a number of that size on modern computing hardware. So that leaves us with one last bit of protection, and that is, well, they throw the data away. They only keep it for 20 minutes. The DOT collects it. They collect the data to do route choice and speed and traffic volume. They don't care who you are. They're not trying to track you. And then they get rid of the data. They're not sharing it with, you know, intelligence agencies and police agencies and so on. They really have no reason to. They don't want this other data about you. So anybody remember this? This is Edward Snowden's slide. You'll note this smiley face by SSL added and removed here of the Muscular project, wherein the data is encrypted to Google's front end, but then once it's in their data center, moving from data center to data center, it's in clear text. And the NSA just tapped their lines. And we have the same thing. The DOT may be throwing your data away after 20 minutes. Is everybody throwing your data away after 20 minutes? We can't really know if this data is stored with or without the cooperation of the DOT. So once again, it is a mitigation. I'm glad they're throwing the data away after 20 minutes. It's nice of them. But all of these are a bit limited in terms of how well they actually protect your privacy. It is creating a nearly nationwide tracking system. Now, I will give them one thing. The alternative to this is usually automated license plate readers. And those are much worse. They get way better than 3 to 6% car identification. And your license plate does map one-to-one to you in a clearly available database that any police agency can access. So if the choice is Bluetooth scanners or putting ALPRs everywhere, well, okay, yeah, they're right. There's no privacy concerns, at least relatively speaking. On the other hand, ALPRs cost 5 times as much, and thus they are less inclined to put them everywhere. Bluetooth scanners are pretty cheap. They're easy for them to deploy, so they're quite widely deployed. So this is what I could find out from reading the literature, but it turns out you can't just Google, where are the Bluetooth scanners in my city? So that data is not really made public. So I thought, well, why don't I make a Bluetooth detector? And so I went on to making my own. And with Bluetooth scanning, first, you have to get some equipment. Bluetooth transceivers, the typical dongle that you can buy anywhere, can send and receive, but they can only send beacons or send when they're paired. They don't have basically packet injection, like we call it on a Wi-Fi card. Class 1 has a 100-meter range. You don't see a lot of those. Class 2 and 3 are 10 and 1 meter, and they're a lot more common. There are also commercial Bluetooth sniffers. These things are $10,000 plus. They will grab all channels. They're receive only. They don't transmit. There's still a single or dual antenna sweep. They won't grab all 64 channels at once. They just rapidly swap between them until you tell them, I'm interested in this Bluetooth device, and then they'll lock on and they'll frequency hop with it. But I didn't want to spend $10,000 on a commercial Bluetooth sniffer. Luckily, there's this lovely thing, which actually you can buy these down in the vendor room. This is the Ubertooth one, and it's a non-commercial Bluetooth scanner. It has all the capabilities I or a Department of Transportation would need to sniff up at least Bluetooth max. 2.4 gigahertz transmit and receive, transmit power and receive sensitivity comparable to a class one Bluetooth device. So this thing's got 100 meter range, comes with a nice little 9 dBi antenna on it. So all I needed was a bit of hardware to attach it to. Have to use Linux because there are no Windows Ubertooth drivers. You could use a Linux VM. The problem is that Windows will not pass a USB device with no driver to the VM. So you actually have to get a copy of, there's a driver called WinUSB, which is just generic Windows USB support, and associate that driver with the Ubertooth and then pass that into your VM, and it works. So my equipment for this at first was an old ThinkPad in the garage. Alternately a VirtualBox VM, a copy of Ubuntu, an Ubertooth 1, a GlobalSat USB GPS dongle for $37 off Amazon, and a ASIO, which is one of those Chinese brands that doesn't actually exist and they just slap a random name on products, USB micro Bluetooth adapter, also class 1, for $16. And so, set up my Linux PC, update it, install libusb and the various USB drivers required, BlueZ, which is a really nice Linux Bluetooth stack, download PiUSB, the Bluetooth baseband, the Ubertooth software, and finally Kismet, although you actually could install binary Kismet. You wouldn't necessarily need to build it all yourself, but you will have to build the Kismet plugin that associates with Ubertooth, so you might as well just download the source you're going to need anyway. Untar, make and install all that, and this is a kind of an older version of Kismet. It's 2013. It is actually the latest released version of Kismet, is a year and a half old. There are newer ones available on GitHub, but actually for stability, you're kind of better off using the old one for... Kismet is meant as a Wi-Fi scanner. It will work as a Bluetooth scanner, but it's kind of pushing it out of its element, so anything that stabilizes it is helpful. And okay, so now I have a computer that can sniff Bluetooth. That was all right, but I didn't really want to drive around with a computer on my dashboard all over the city for hours till the battery ran out and have to, you know, go back and swap another one. So I thought, you know what would be cooler is if I had this on a little embedded system that I can just stick on the dashboard and plug into the cigarette lighter and do it all that way. So I built an ARM-based Bluetooth scanner. And let's show you a bit of that. So it's it was an inexpensive open source hardware platform, the Raspberry Pi. It's made for education purposes, basically to show you here's how you play with little embedded systems. It's an ARM processor. It's $35. You can probably buy them in the vendor room too. And it's got two USB ports, HDMI, audio, GPIO pins with SPI capability, and all sorts of things I don't need for a Bluetooth scanner. I also went ahead and bought a screen and an enclosure for it because I didn't want to drive all over town for 5 hours, then get home and find out I captured no data. So I wanted to actually have some kind of readout. It's optional. I wouldn't have needed the readout. It'd work just fine without it. And then the equipment from the PC build. And finally, I needed something to power it off of. It runs on a 5-volt, 500 milliamp USB power supply. So it's meant to plug it into just any normal USB adapter, which is great, because a car charger has a USB adapter on it. So now I can plug it into my cigarette lighter. So let me show you what I built here. The problem I have is I cannot see my own screen. So I am going to show you with my camera here what is built, but you will have to tell me if I am not actually aiming at it. So here is... Is that in focus?
Yeah.
Okay, so here is the Raspberry Pi with a display on it. Those are a bunch of Bluetooth MAC addresses and the number of packets it's captured from. I turned this on in the speaker room about 45 minutes ago, and as you can see, there's a nice long list of Bluetooth MACs that I have captured from friendly DEF CON goers. Over here is what it is plugged into. We've got that in focus there? Okay, so we've got a USB hub. which has on it my GPS dongle, which is getting no reception here in the Rio, but in theory it could, and my Ubertooth One. And then finally we have what's powering all those. This is a $29 Gorilla Gadget 16,800 milliamp cell phone recharger. Also works as a USB power source. So those all together give me a less than $200 embedded system for use as a Bluetooth scanner. All right, am I back to slides? Okay. So setting this up was pretty straightforward. Update the Pi firmware. I used the standard Raspbian image. There's actually an image available from adafruit.com that already has support for the screen. So if you are using the screen, then you can use that as well. And it precompiles in. A bunch of kernel patches are required to use the screen on a Raspberry Pi, because it actually repurposes the general purpose I/O pins as a high-speed bus to transmit and receive from the screen. Install the same packages as before, although a few others are necessary. Actually, I don't list it there. You also need Build Essential. Raspbian does not, by default, include some of the toolchain packages you need to build all this stuff. But apt is pretty friendly about telling you what you're missing. Download the usual software and make and install all that. One thing is, the Raspberry Pi is not the fastest dev platform out there. Compiling Kismet on the Pi takes about 4.5 hours. So as a result, if you're going to be doing a lot of experimenting with this, it's probably worth setting up a Linux box to cross-compile, because that's going to be a hell of a lot faster. But if you're only compiling Kismet once on the device, it's not that big of a deal to just, you know, let it compile for 4.5 hours and install. And then I did a little more setup, putting my user into the plug dev group and setting up USB to automatically associate the Ubertooth with that so that I can run Kismet in user mode instead of having to run it as root. And I added a new user called Scanner, and that user is in the appropriate groups. And I modified init tab to, instead of displaying a login prompt on TTY1, the console, to automatically log in the Scanner user. And that way, when I boot up the Pi, it automatically displays the Scanner user's console on the screen, and I don't have to plug a keyboard into it and do any kind of login. And then set GPSD to start up. This is actually necessary because GPSD on Raspbian, there seems to be a bug in the install packages, and it will not auto-start. And if you do dpackage reconfigure to tell it to auto-start, it writes a bad GPSD config that doesn't actually work. So edit GPSD config to make it work. And then finally start up Kismet on a computer where you have a keyboard and a screen, because you have to set up the Kismet UI the way you like it to look, and then exit, and that will save all your UI settings to display the Ubertooth plugin and not display all the 802.11 stuff we're not using, to display the GPS coordinates and that sort of thing. Then finally, modify the Scanner user's bash RC to start up Kismet as soon as they log in. And so the screen we saw on the little scanner a minute ago, that's what it boots to. I just plug in power and it immediately starts running. And it worked great to just take it into my car with a car charger and drive around town with it and record logs. And when I get home, the Pi has an Ethernet adapter, so I plug it into a network and SSH into it and pull off all the log files. And I pulled off quite a lot of log files from it. So there were a few issues with the Raspberry Pi. One is, you'll note I've got that USB hub, even though I've only got two devices plugged into it, and the Pi has two USB ports. Problem is, the Pi's USB ports only supply 140 milliamps, and that's not really enough to drive a Ubertooth and a Bluetooth transceiver and a GPS. So I needed external power, so I grabbed a powered USB hub. Of course, the other problem I had with that is the powered USB hub has to plug into something, and USB hubs normally have a wall wart. And so what I did is I took the wall wart, cut the cord, took a USB cable, cut that cord, soldered the power cords in the wall wart cord to the power pins on the USB cord, and then just plug it into the same car charger as the Pi. And so I've got a custom-made power cord for the thing. The only other issue I ran into is I cannot solder worth a damn. I found this out the hard way when putting this together and made plenty of mistakes with, I think that was my second power cable, and had to do a lot of desoldering to get the screen soldered on. But as a result, I can solder now. So that was an added benefit of this project, even if it took a few extra hours of work. Finally, Kismet on Ubertooth and Kismet on the Pi sometimes crashes with this corrupted double link list error. Usually happens right at startup. If it does crash, it's fine. You just run Kismet again, and usually it doesn't crash the second time. If it doesn't crash in the first 2 minutes, it usually doesn't. I actually wrote a script so that Kismet's client and server are started separately. And if the server goes down, it just cycles it and starts it up again, and then the client reconnects to the server so that I, once again, don't have to have a keyboard, don't have to SSH in. The device just runs autonomously, and it recovers from its own faults. I also have been working with people on GitHub to try to figure out what exactly this bug is, because it doesn't just happen on Raspbian. It happens on Kali also. And that's a platform they would really like Ubertooth to work properly on. And it's weird, because Kali is based on Ubuntu, and it works great on Ubuntu 12.04.4 and 14.04, and it doesn't work on Kali. And we don't seem to be able to figure out why. So thanks to Dominic Spill for his help in debugging this, even if we have not quite figured out how to get it 100% reliable yet. But the fault-tolerant script works, so I'm still able to gather data. So we can scan with Ubertooth scan, which performs an inquiry scan, sends out beacons. That needs both an Ubertooth 1 and a Bluetooth transceiver. That'll tell us the LAP only, nothing else, just lower address part. Or we can use Kismet, which will passively monitor all frequencies, takes only the Ubertooth 1, and it logs GPS coordinates constantly as well as logging our data packets. So that's what I use for most of my data gathering, because I need coordinates. I need to know exactly where I observed all these Bluetooth addresses. It's a continuous sweep. It will miss things because it's only getting one packet in 64 from each connection. And if it gets enough packets to guess UAP, it will do so. So I have UAP on some of the addresses I captured and not others. The amount of time an inquiry scan needs to be sure it got everybody is 10.24 seconds. So if I'm going at highway speeds, about 60 miles an hour, that means 268.2 meters of driving in order to be sure I caught everything around me. A class one transceiver is 100 meters. It should be mostly enough to get at least the great majority of devices, but I have to accept that I'm not going to get everything unless I drive by over and over and over again. So then we get to the results. First of all, after I got all those logs, I loaded them into Wireshark in order to parse the Kismet logs and basically dump everything but the MAC address, because I don't care about the data. I don't need the contents of the packets. All I really want is the Bluetooth addresses. So dumped all that to a ridiculously massive CSV. Was very happy to have Excel 2013, because the 32-bit versions of Excel would have choked on my 16-gigabyte spreadsheet. The 64-bit version was not delighted by it either, but it was able to work with it. So, and here we have a whole bunch of packets from, you will notice, 98B3316, the generic inquiry access code. So these are beacons that were picked up. And then I mapped them all out on Google Maps. So these are areas on the Seattle highways that are showing recurrent inquiry activity. So these are, I found an emitter of Bluetooth inquiries on every pass of these locations, implying that there is a stationary Bluetooth source. Now, yes, it could be somebody semi pulled off the side of the road for 5 hours. I can't rule out the possibility that these are not scanners. These are happens to be stationary Bluetooth sources that are trying to pair all the time. It seems maybe a little unlikely, but it is circumstantial evidence. The other thing is these locations match expected spots for route choice tracking. If you look at where they are, we've got the on-ramp to a highway over in Redmond. We've got a place before the highways diverge up on the north side of Seattle. Likewise, we've got a couple of places on the south side of Seattle just before major intersections with high traffic. We've got a couple downtown between I-520 and I-90, which are the main thoroughfares across the bridge. They're places I would expect the DOT to want to put scanners. So combined with that, that's what we got. This said, there are not as many as I would expect. So I have probably missed a fair number of them. I also did not spend all week driving around Seattle. So I could probably gather more if I spent more time gathering data. Well, that tells me with inquiry scans, but what if they're not doing inquiry scans? What if they're doing other types of Bluetooth scans? So I loaded in the data of all the MAC addresses, not just the inquiries, and looked for what's the first time I spotted this, what's the last time I spotted this, how far apart are they in hours, and if they were more than half an hour apart, then in the same location, that is a stationary source. So I looked at all the ones I spotted more than an hour apart from themselves, and then calculated the Haversine distance between those locations. Haversine distance is distance across the surface of the sphere. It's the way you calculate distance if you have GPS coordinates. And I found a variety of them that had a very small Haversine distance and a very large time difference, once again implying a stationary Bluetooth emitter. And they tended to look like this. We had multiple areas where an address was found for less than 200 meter, in a less than 200 meter area on multiple passes around the highways. I'd show you a map of these, but honestly, it looks a whole lot like the other map did. They were, for the most part, a subset of the inquiry stand locations. I saw them at the same places. What this means, I'm not sure. They could be using multiple transceivers. They could be false positives. It's a little difficult to know what to make of that data. Notably absent, though, there weren't any on the State Road 520 bridge. Which surprises me only because if we saw in the Star Labs experiments, that's where they were testing them originally. In addition, the 520 bridge has dynamic speed limit signs. So they are definitely calculating travel times for cars and calculating speed. They've got some sort of traffic monitoring on there. And they've got Bluetooth scanners. So I would think those things would be connected. But despite quite a few passes, I did not find evidence that that is the case. This said, unlike when they were doing the experiments, the 520 bridge is a toll bridge now, and that means people have toll passes. So they may have just switched to using the electronic tolling sensors and abandoned doing Bluetooth sensors on that bridge now that they've got a potentially more reliable and more uniquely identifiable way of tracking it. On the other hand, that once again won't give them route choice. It'll tell them people are crossing the bridge, won't tell them where they're going afterwards, unless they've put hidden toll sensors elsewhere that don't charge you a toll. But that may be getting into paranoia territory, but that's what DEF CON is for. So countermeasures. What do we do about this, or do we need to do anything about it? Well, first of all, there is going back to recognizing that if they weren't doing this, they'd probably put license plate readers everywhere, and that would be worse. But nevertheless, the main thing you can do is, of course, turn off your phone. Unfortunately, it's a little harder to turn off the Bluetooth transceivers that are built into your car. Depending on your car, sometimes they don't have an off. They may transmit to anything that transmits to them. Some of them basically beacon continuously. They're pretty easy to detect. If you want to know, you just build one of these things and you sniff your own car and see what you've got. You can check your own Bluetooth emanations. I know I found that my car does not beacon continuously, but if it's powered on, or if it's been powered on in the last 10 minutes, it is sending Bluetooth packets. So now I have devices it's paired to relatively near it, but nevertheless, I'm not making a hands-free call. I'm not playing Bluetooth radio. The ignition's turned off and I'm not in the car, and it's still exchanging Bluetooth data. So these devices are relatively leaky from an information perspective, and there's not a whole lot you can do about that. This said, this kind of leaking requires passive scanning and not the inquiry scans, which are probably what most DOTs are using. If I look at the commercial products, that's mostly what they're doing. If you kind of read between the lines of what the capabilities are, and they talk about only finding discoverable devices, inquiry scans only find discoverable devices. Passive scans will find all devices. All devices aren't turned off. The other thing you can do that's kind of interesting is you can be someone else. I can run my sniffer and look at all those nice LAPs I got. And if I know who one of them belongs to, I can just, this sniffer works just as well as a spoofer. I can plug in a couple of Bluetooth dongles, and then with BlueSmash tools, which are included in Backtrack and Kali, common open source security tools, just change my Bluetooth adapters to spoof other Bluetooth Macs of my choice. And then I just pair them off with each other so they'll start leaking data everywhere and drive around, and now I can be someone else. If this is being used as a surveillance system, if they are tracking people this way, I can lay a false trail. And with my one device, I can lay a false trail of as many devices as I want. If I know somebody's car has got 5 Bluetooth devices in it, that's fine. I've got a hub. I can plug in multiple transceivers and leak all the data I want. And so, yeah, you can duplicate multiple addresses with multiple transceivers. So that's where my current state was. I do have a little bit of follow-up ideas for what I'm going to do with it next. One is, now that I've got these stationary locations, I'm going to go to them and try to pair with them. Because if I make a connection attempt, and they are commodity Bluetooth hardware, they should give me their manufacturer and their service class and all the other data necessary to negotiate a connection. I don't need to actually connect to them. But I'm curious, because once again, if they all have the same manufacturer, that's another piece of evidence that, yes, these are probably scanners and not just some truck parked by the side of the highway. So that is my current state. So do we have any questions? Yes?
You talked about how the DOT says they're only taking 3-6%. Is there any way to know that's actually what they're doing, as opposed to putting the dragnet out and capturing 100%?
So the question was, is there any way to know they're actually only collecting 3-6% and not capturing a dragnet? Well, truth is, they're trying to capture a dragnet. But that's part of the evidence that they're doing inquiry scans. Because if you're doing inquiry scans, you only get discoverable devices, and most devices are not discoverable. Also, because of the frequency hopping spread spectrum, you're only getting one packet in 64. So that's where that 3-6% comes from. It's not that they're trying to do sampling or trying to protect privacy. It's that the scanning methodology they use loses a lot of packets. And because the DOT is just doing statistical analysis, they don't care. They don't have any incentive to capture more packets. They don't have any incentive to make the system better. That's good enough for them. So really, the only evidence we have is the kind of assume that DOTs have fixed budgets and they're not going to spend money on stuff that doesn't actually improve their mission. Unless the NSA wants to pay for it, the NSA probably has to take what they can get from them. So, yes?
What did you call that tool that was built into Kali and Backtrack?
Tool built into Kali and Backtrack? Well, let's see. There's the Ubertooth tools in Kismet, but you may be thinking of BlueSmash tools, which include a command line Bluetooth MAC changer. This said, you don't even necessarily need that. The BlueZ library, that's the key Bluetooth library of Linux, will allow you to specify MAC addresses to your devices. I think you may even be able to do it with HCI tool. I'm not certain about that, but they're, on Linux, Bluetooth MACs are user programmable. You can set that. It's actually kind of nice because the BlueZ stack was basically Linux's Bluetooth support was written open source from the start. So a lot of the great stuff that we had to clone drivers in the Wi-Fi world to manage to get to work was just built in there from the ground up on Bluetooth. So it's been quite convenient for people like me. So. Anything else?
How the devices communicate with each other?
How the scanners communicate with each other? I've not looked into that. Like I said, they said either Ethernet or cell modem is the way all of the manufacturers I looked at advertise the communication. If it's cell modem, yeah, you could use a software radio and try to interpret that. It's probably 2G cell modem. They don't need much bandwidth at all. If it's Ethernet, obviously, it's a little harder to tap. There's a question over there. So the question was, is there some mechanism like acknowledgement frames in Bluetooth where you can stimulate a response from somebody else? And yes, there is. In fact, the Ubertooth scan tool does basically that. It spews out a bunch of packets to get responses from things. The main thing, though, is beaconing. If a device is discoverable, that's exactly what the GIAC address packets do, is you send them out, and they're basically screaming, does anyone want to pair with me? And any device that's discoverable will respond, yes, this is my address, and they can allow initiating connection. All right. Oh, one more. The question was, is this classic Bluetooth and not BLE? Yes, it is. Because those devices in cars, all the headsets and so on, those are Bluetooth 1.0 and 2.0. Those aren't BLE devices. They're not Bluetooth Smart. Bluetooth Smart is actually a hell of a lot easier to sniff than classic Bluetooth is. But in this case, that's not what they're using because the particular devices they want to track, that's not what they're using. All right, so I've got the link to where I've got a copy of my slides up on my blog. I will update those to the current copy of the slides today. And I will also, within the next week, be kind of posting this talk in more white paper oriented format on perimetergrid.com. So, all right, thanks.